Hello and welcome to Ed Talks, the podcast that has been commissioned by the Development Office at King Edward School Birmingham and King Edward's High School for Girls, where I talk to old Edwardians who've gone on to do some weird and wonderful things with their careers and in all sorts of different fields. My name is Ben Anderson. I left school in 2006 and I went to be a radio producer working for Capital FM. I now run my own business, Sound Rebel, and we produce podcasts. Today, I'm joined by an old Edwardian who left school at the end of the 90s, started her career as a lawyer, and then moved into consumer tech about 6 years ago. She's now an entrepreneur, founder, and CEO of Little Black Door. I'd love to welcome to the podcast Lexi Willits. Lexi, thanks so much for your time today.
Hi, Ben. Nice to meet you.
So whereabout in the country are you at the moment, Lexi? Because you still have a bit of a tie to Birmingham.
I do, yeah. And in fact, I find myself in Birmingham today, just in Harborne, and some maybe 5 minutes away from school days. But usually I'm floating around the world, I must say. I work in and around London, but I'm still based in Zurich as well. So it's very often a bags packed, off we go situation with me, unfortunately.
I lived in Harborne for a good few years. Is there any chance for plough pizza before you head back on a plane?
There is always a possibility of a plough pizza. I'm very pleased to see their back garden is back open now. So yeah, we're big fans of the plough. Probably spent far too much money there at some point.
Oh yes, let's not think about it. Instead, let's talk about your school days, because I would love to talk about Zurich and what took you over there shortly. I mean, Birmingham has changed massively, but what was Birmingham like as a teenager in the 90s?
Birmingham was alive, especially in the music scene. I think, you know, certainly when I started to creep out, you know, the nightlife scene was just growing. We just started to see live music really come into its own in Birmingham, or certainly my sphere of consciousness. It was the kind of heady days of Oasis and Ocean Colour scene. It was very, very much about kind of meeting, greeting and being out in a very live city. So in some respects, I think Birmingham has changed quite a lot since then. I come back now and we've kind of moved much more into this food and gastro restaurant scene rather than this kind of hedonistic party underground club scene that was alive and well when I was young.
And in terms of school, did you enjoy your school days? One of the great things about this podcast is you don't have to say yes just because it's been commissioned by the Development Office.
However, I hand on heart can say that I genuinely love school. It was an easy time for me. So I was involved with maybe two or three different types of groups of people at all times. But I have a core group of friends that I stick with even today. So it's certainly, it was a great experience.
On the academic side of things, what were your strong subjects? What did you enjoy the most?
Yeah, a bit like my life, I was quite schizophrenic, actually. So ancient history was and English literature were probably my number ones. But then ironically, I mixed that with economics and business. So I'm kind of very curious about what the world was and what's going on in the world now and how to verbalise that, I suppose. So those core subject groups really resonated for me and my personality. I was tragic, absolutely tragic at anything that was scientific. So I kind of steered away from that. In fact, I tried to drop as many science subjects as possible before GCSE, and I certainly didn't keep them going to A-level. But my core kind of interest subjects, I then kind of continued beyond school. And those seemed to kind of creep into my daily life ever since then.
You studied law. Is it IP law specifically?
No. And in fact, when I first went to Birmingham University, I opted for law and business. So it was a hybrid course. But I didn't get on too well with that. It wasn't quite 50-50. It was almost like a 75-75. I did that over at Birmingham University. And after about 6 months, I thought, you know what, I'm struggling here. And it was the first time that I hadn't really enjoyed an academic experience. And I think King Edwards, I was probably middle ground. I wasn't at the bottom of the class. I wasn't at the top of the class, but I was, I held my own. And I think when I went to university, it was the first time that I thought, God, I'm struggling. And I spoke with my tutors, and especially on the legal side, and Bryn Perrins was one of my tutors at the time and said, just come back and do straight law. It's obviously, you know, you're not coping with diving through all of these different topics all the time. So I then restarted and took interest in lots of different areas of law, contract, a bit of IP, music, liquor licensing, some really random stuff, you know, some really kind of practical stuff. And continued that. I went to do the LPC after university. And from there, I took a short break out of law when I first graduated. I was quite interested in employment law at the time, but I couldn't get a job in a training contract straight away. So, you know, I'm very cash orientated. I like my lifestyle. So I took a role with Michael Page, started recruiting. And I was recruiting a lot of lawyers around Birmingham and actually up until about Nottingham as well, and managed to recruit myself into my next job. So I'd met a partner who was a patent and trademark attorney, actually, who we got into a deep conversation one afternoon. And he said, "You'd be very good for brand law. Why don't you think about it?" So I then started a journey which was to top up my legal skills. And then I spent the next 2 years taking... I broke into that world. I was offered a job with Marks & Clark. And I spent the next 2 to 3 years then taking top-up papers to qualify me as a trademark attorney. And there started my first foray into intellectual property.
There seems to be a bit of a theme, Lexi, of kind of spotting and then taking opportunities. I read something that said that when you were 17, that was the only time that you've ever planned your career. In terms of your law career then, so with the IP, you ended up in Zurich and you were working for FIFA.
Yeah, so I'd worked in private practice with Marks & Clark for a couple of years. And I'm quite client driven. You know, I think of it from the perspective of being the client. And as a result, you know, I kind of realised that probably in-house was more likely to suit me than being part of a law firm setup. I think within a law firm setup environment, you set yourself a path, which is, am I aiming to be partner? You know, am I bound to training others and ratcheting up the clock for fees every month? You know, is that me or do I want something slightly more commercial? So I'd happened to see a role that came up at FIFA, and I'd been lucky that in my portfolio of clients in Birmingham, I looked after Aston Villa and West Bromwich Albion as part of their trademark portfolio. So I'd already had a mix into sports rights and you know, what were being leveraged and what assets were being created to leverage within sports agreements. And I was fortunate that, you know, I just happened to see the job online, applied. 6 months later, they gave me a call. I'd forgotten about it completely. And said, "Would you like to come for a first interview?" And I think at the point that they flew me out for an interview, I thought I'd made it. I didn't need the job after that. I was just so excited to be flown somewhere for an interview. I was like, that's enough. That'll do me. And when I was flown back for the second interview and realised, actually, oh my God, I'm part of the two here that are up for the role, you know, the gods looked favourably upon me and I was offered. So, and that started my in-house career, but also allowed me to, you know, become a manager as well. You know, I'd got a team of anything up to five that I was working with. I was part of a greater commercial legal team as, you know, lead on IP to feed into their contracts. And then suddenly I'd got five commercial teams, marketing, sales, licensing, etc., that were not reporting into me, but, you know, I was their lead counsel on many topics. And the more useful you are, the more people start knocking on your door, which is a bit of a headache. But yeah, that was my first foray into what was, you know, a very big sports entertainment piece.
If you wouldn't mind indulging a slight tangent, who would you say were nice to work with, Aston Villa or West Bromwich Albion?
Well, I've been a Baggies fan.
And never mind, that tangent's now been followed. In terms of your career with FIFA, would you mind if I asked how old you were when you landed that role?
Yeah, I was, how old was I? I was 28 when I got the role and 29 when I took it.
Because that seems like, in terms of a big, high-profile job, that's got to be one of the biggest, doesn't it? It's one of the biggest organisations in the world for one of the biggest, if not the biggest, sports in the world. And you've got that in your 20s. What I'm trying to say is it kind of feels like the kind of job you get and then keep for a really, really long time. So I'm interested to find out why you didn't.
Yeah, I mean, I completed that role for a full World Cup cycle. But you must appreciate that that role was very all-encompassing. And it's very easy to, you know, I had this big debate with my mum, actually, when I left. She was horrified that I was leaving. But it was my choice. You know, I'd worked 4 years relentlessly. You know, we were custodian of so many trademarks, it was untrue. And for the first time, during my tenure, for the first time, FIFA announced 2 World Cups together rather than one, which doubled the size of our workload. In fact, it almost tripled it. But my team wasn't tripled. So, you know, my work was just growing. And, you know, I was sleeping average 4 hours, 5 hours a night. I was shifting between time zones where I was working on a number of projects at the same time. So we were shifting between, we were finishing off South Africa. We were working on Brazil, which was delayed. We'd started to roll out Russia. And then Qatar were very keen to start activating as well. So they needed some tournament assets developing. They also wanted their special legislation working out. Such a hectic role that it didn't really lend itself to any type of personal life. And during that time, certainly in the last year, my father was diagnosed with stomach cancer. So my free time was spent coming back to Birmingham every other weekend to see him, which was complicated because my mum had multiple sclerosis and still does and was becoming very disabled with it. And my dad was her primary carer. And I'm an only child. So it was, you know, you have to look at your life and think, can I service every area well? And it was taking so, you know, work was so much that I just had nothing for anyone else at the end of the day. So, you know, I took it for the experience that it was. It grew me in an expedited way that I'm very thankful for. It gave me my first international working experience. It gave me my first big manager experience or leadership experience. And it put me on a very different internationalized platform for working. So, you know, it certainly broadened the mind and the skill set, but in a very rapid time frame.
Lexi, you admitted before we started recording that you are not one of the many thousands of people who have listened to series one of this podcast. So you would not have heard some of my interviews with old heads who've gone on to creative careers. In terms of law, did you feel as if that was something that you should do? Because obviously what you do now is very, very different. If that double World Cup hadn't been announced, for example, would you still be in that profession?
I think you've got to really enjoy, you know, what you commit your most energy to. Work is such a big part of life in terms of hours spent. You know, it's an old adage, but everyone fires it at you. You know, you've really got to love what you do. So I chose to study law primarily because at age 17, I couldn't think of anything else to do. And law seemed to be an amalgamation of the topics and the kind of skills that I was learning within those topics, you know, at A-level, and seemed to kind of wrap neatly into, okay, well, I could study law, couldn't I? And I didn't really have a discipline in mind at the time. You know, what specialism would I eventually fall into? And I kept my modules at university very broad as well to kind of get a flavour of different areas. And as I say, employment was the only thing that really kind of excited me. And that was because I was dealing with people and their stories and their journeys and how can I help to sort you out. So, you know, mapping that forward, I think in terms of FIFA and on a career level and an advice level, we should always be unfolding and learning more and evolving. And I think you can only do that so much within one job. You know, you need new environments, new stimulations, new types of topics coming at you. And FIFA was newness personified in respect that we were constantly helping teams come up with new assets to protect. There was new cases all the time. new people in the mix, new countries, but the work was essentially the same. So you were just not copying, pasting, but you were effectively rolling out the same program year after year after year with a couple of tweaks, depending on the country considerations. Football is not my mecca. For others at FIFA, football was their mecca. You know, fashion is my mecca. And I was more interested in the deals with Hublot, Louis Vuitton, Adidas than I was anything else. So, you know, following the passion, I kind of got to the end of what was a fairly tiring 4 years and thought, what do I actually want to do? So I took a career break. I went back to university. I took a master's in luxury brand management with no agenda that to learn about a space that I really love. I love the tangibility of, you know, kind of luxury fashion, the joy of it. I thought, right, let me go and see what this world is about. I'm going to study, and fortuitously, that set me on a path of where I am today.
Which is founder and CEO of Little Black Door, which is a social wardrobe app, which is it women or people can use to share and sell the contents of their wardrobe?
The first iteration is very much a female brand, unashamedly. We are an inclusive brand, but obviously product categories, product design tends to be slightly different for guys. You know, we're kind of the Netta Porter versus Mr. Porter, if you like. So, yeah, we are very female focused. And, yeah, we're building, you know, our ambition is that every woman in the world should have her wardrobe on her phone. You know, the mechanic to dashboard what exactly we're buying now. There's so much e-data flying around that it seems almost illogical that we haven't created a product that, you know, dashboards what we have in our wardrobes in the same way that we dashboard our finance or any other kind of consumer product that literally lives on an app on our phone. So we've been developing that for about, well, just over 18 months properly, and we're soon to soft launch in London. So a big part of our, you know, use case is that, you know, your wardrobe is private, but you could share that with friends. And it kind of takes me back to my school days, which is we've got so much in a habit of buying rather than borrowing for a night out or for an occasion that you're just amassing so much stuff. Whereas, you know, when I was 16, 17 and we were about to do a night out with the girls at school, I would shuffle around Claire Jones's wardrobe and kind of, as friends, you tend to have very similar styles. And if you're lucky enough, you're the same size or you try and make it fit in some which way. So, yeah, we actively encourage kind of sharing wardrobes between friends and sharing to resale. So we have a great partnership that's coming up, which allows our users to swipe off to up to something like 27 marketplaces in the same swipe and be very hands off and have no hassle with that.
So what does that mean? Because I'm thinking, where do we start with this? There's so many different things I want to ask you about, because it's, you know, it opens up the conversation around fast fashion, around launching tech apps and being a female in that space as well. How does it work then? Can we start there? So I am a user, or let's say my girlfriend Jem, because my God, she's going to absolutely love this app. So what's the experience for the user?
Yeah, we try and concentrate, you know, we position this very much about your future wardrobe. So we try and concentrate this now is that you can add your collections. We have a very fun magic scan AI, and then it's just a quick click of how much you pay for it, the brand and the name of the item, and it's in the wardrobe and it's digitalized. We're also making quite a few links now with EPOS systems. So, you know, as you're buying online, if the brand or store that you happen to be buying with is with Shopify, there'll be an app there which will allow you, if you've got the same account, you can just have a copy of your receipt go into your Little Black Door. We have some store partners that we're working with over the years. So as you're buying, it will go straight into your Little Black Door. And then once you have items in your wardrobe, that's when you can start to play around. And also, if you know, our lookbook is our core way to publish your wardrobe to other people, whether you do that with friends or you do that to your public, you know, because you've got a following, or you're doing it with your personal stylist, or you're sharing your wardrobe with a brand, etc. And obviously when you're ready to sell, you just swipe to sell. So we use the, you know, very much in a Tinderized way. No, I keep, oh no, maybe I sell that. So we have a very fun swipe to sell button. It's basically what are we doing with fashion at the moment? I'm like, you know, I'm buying it, I'm sharing it. I've been kind of cataloguing it for about 7 years on Instagram anyway, in this kind of outfit of the day. Here's my outfit, tag, tag, tag. So yeah, that's, you know, that's kind of, it's a great wardrobe world that we're building.
So obviously you said this idea came from your love of fashion, and it's a personal love of fashion that you've had for a really long time. What was it about this specific idea, the idea of everyone having a wardrobe online?
I guess it was a marriage of many worlds and things that were kind of happening in my own day-to-day life, which was I was always on the road, never really understood what I got, kept forgetting what I got, very often repeat buying as a result. I would always buy beautiful handbags. I would very often sell them to buy the next one. So I'm kind of fashion flipping all the time as well. And then during that time, I was working with a girl called Marina, who I'd hired some 3 years before. And every time I moved jobs or did something, I grabbed her and brought her with me. And Marina is the, you know, this kind of wild thinker. And we happened to be on a roadshow somewhere. I think we were in Korea at the time.
What's a roadshow? Sorry, Lexi.
So very often, if you're about to launch a new tech product or you have launched, you will showcase that. You know, you can showcase that locally or you can showcase it around the world, which is kind of, you know, you take it on a roadshow to show people what you're up to. And we were on one of those at the time with a project that we were both working on. And I think I walked into Zara and Marina said, I picked up a top and Marina said, you've got that and you've got three of them. She's quite Rain Man in that respect. And then there started a bit the nugget of the idea, you know, just how had we got into this behavioural cycle of consuming to a point that you just don't even know what you have anymore. And then, you start to examine your behaviour with fashion. And I guess that's where the product started from. So Marina was very much the instigator of Little Black Door. And she comes up with wild ideas and I edit them down a bit. And I go, that feels right. Or that doesn't feel right. Oh, we could get a business model out of that. So between the two of us, Little Black Door was conceptualized and fortuitously now exists as a product. But it was a product journey that was some 18 months in its making. We aren't pure technologists. You know, I don't code. So we found a tech team that could help us build and realize what, you know, the product that we wanted. And then we piloted that in London early 2020 for some 4 months. We took the findings of that pilot, we took the customer feedback from that pilot, and then we went back to a redesign, stepped it up, added way more fun social features to the app, which kind of really interacted, you know, a community and an audience around a wardrobe. And that led us now to the point where we, you know, we're just doing a fundraise to get us through to our second stage of the business. This is kind of phase two, if you like. We've gone past the R&D stage now. We're into launch marketing stage and, you know, we're ready to go. So it's apps don't just happen. So, you spend some time thinking about what type of product you want, how to make it. Then you need people to build it with you. If you can't build it yourself, then you've got to go through a stage where you're kind of pushing it into everyone's psyche, introducing it to the industry that we're in. So it's, you know, stage by stage, piece by piece, very often at the same time. And that's, you know, that brings us to now.
Hi, I'm Salma.
And I'm Shweb.
We're student fundraisers talking to you about the Assisted Places Fund.
So, I suppose you're wondering, why should you donate to the Assisted Places Fund?
Essentially, we want to help give others the opportunities we were both fortunate enough to have and give them access to our wide-ranging curriculum and ambitious co-curricular programme.
Thank you for listening. And to give, visit the Old Edwardian website.
The user experience of it sounds great. I'm not sure where I've read this, but Little Black Door creates conscious consumption and encourages investment in quality slow fashion. Obviously, environmental issues are always something that we're thinking about. Is this the fact that you're asking people to think about the world of fast fashion? Is that just a bonus to this, or was that kind of fundamental to the creation of Little Black Door?
No, that's entrenched in what we do. I'm guilty as charged for, you know, fashion bad behaviours over time, especially, you know, getting into cycles of buying and buying and buying. You know, I am the person who could walk into Zara and buy everything every week. And I'd probably wear it once, and then I'm like, what am I doing with that? So, you know, Zara has its place, whether it's for great tailoring, you know, a sensible price point. But I think there's a lot more, I would say, fast, very cheap, destructive fashion, which has come through over the last few years. We're quite anti-boohoo, I must say. We take a position on that for many reasons. You know, their supply chains, factories, treatment of women, low-paid labour, selling items for £2. How is that even possible? You know, the unit economics are so disgusting. And the ricochet effect that, you know, platforms like that cause, I think really need to be absorbed by Gen Zs and rejected by them. So very much the, you know, the passion project that we've created is not just the fun, playful tech, but, you know, if you're going to try and correct a position or retrain behaviours or a better relationship with fashion, tech very often does that without you even realising. Tech creates new behaviour. We see the way that people are interacting, the way that people meet now, you know, the same as what dating apps did for meeting partners. You know, we try and reconnect you with your wardrobe to give you a very quick visual on what you have, but also, you know, kind of educate you and encourage you. Look, you don't necessarily have to buy every time. You can borrow, which is great. You know, the rentals market for clothing and fashion is growing exponentially at the moment, so we kind of fit neatly within that. We also, in our first year, knocked on the door of the UN in New York on their Sustainable Development Goals team and said, what do we do to work within your partnership requirements? So that, you know, that was key to us. And 2019, we met with a global partnerships head who said, yeah, you know, you're more than welcome to use our logo if you're sticking to this. So it's, you know, that was central to what we're doing. It's kind of, how do we just get into a better way and a better behaviour with fashion, rather than just really not being cognizant of it?
I'd love to talk to you a bit about what it's like being an entrepreneur. What are the differences between working for that big corporate company and going it alone?
I think it's very different, actually. You know, I've met many people who think they want to be consultants or not necessarily entrepreneurs, because an entrepreneur has to, you know, by design must be making something, doing something, you know, reshaping something, or at least, you know, creating a business from scratch. Whereas consultants, you know, I have friends who are freelancers who, and I think it's the same for them too, you know, that they start off with a viewpoint that they would like freedom, the ability to work from anywhere. But actually, the life of the entrepreneur and the consultant slash freelancer is very often that you are not free. You know, you are bound in a very different way, which is you have got to make sure that the next gig is there or money is available to do what you're doing. So you're hustling all the time, and you need to ask for favours. You need to be knocking on doors to ask for opportunities to grow and to develop something. And as the entrepreneur, certainly in the beginning, you don't necessarily have power to give back or to just do what you want to do for yourself. Whereas you never really are faced with that level of uncertainty or kind of instability when you have a 9-to-5 job. You know, I never worried whilst I was in private practice or working with FIFA, do you think I'll get paid this month? And as a result, your life choices and the way that you structure your free time and everything else changes dramatically when you are an entrepreneur. Because there's no off time. there really isn't, you know, there is not one day, even if I say to my, you know, my partner, we'll do something today. There is not one day at some point that you are not involved in your business in some which way, whether it's thinking about it, answering an email, correcting something, you know, working with a team member. There is no off. You are always on, and you always need to be on, and you've got to be very comfortable with that. When I started Little Black Door, a friend of mine who is also an entrepreneur, but also a very seasoned consultant in London, he's a heart surgeon, who has a business in the tech space called MedShare. He said, are you ready? Are you prepared for this? Because this will be minimum 5 years that you have to put into this. There is no walking away from this. And you obviously say yes, but you know, life can change in the background over a 5 year period. And I started this at a point of life where I was coming up to 39. So you know, I'm not starting this as a kind of mid 20s, even early 30s. I'm, you know, the wrong end of 30 in some which ways. So what you have to appreciate is that to be an entrepreneur means that you very often take work as the priority. And then your life fits in around that, which is not for everyone.
In terms of becoming an entrepreneur later on then, I mean, you know, I say later on, but you're right. Tech entrepreneurs, will often you think of somebody like Zuckerberg, who has a great idea at university and jumps straight into it. Do you think actually that having had a great career in a completely different sphere, did that help set you up for Little Black Door and the challenges that come with that, or is it just a completely different version of Lexi?
The kind of training in the past that I've had equips me probably to deal with, I don't like the word stress, but it's, you know, the word stress. Because when you're juggling projects, budgets, people, trying to keep things on track, very often small, you know, early startups fail because of the relationships that they have with people or the relationships that they have within the entrepreneurial team, the founding team, can be quite strained when times are pressurized. And, you know, Marina and I have had at least two episodes where we've not had money for the business. So we've had to do everything that we could between the two of us to make sure that the wheels stayed on the project. And you make a lot of personal sacrifice during that time. So it's, you know, I think as time has gone on, the bigger picture for me is that I'll always have a job, you know, regardless of where this goes or if this is a hard experience. You know, we tried, we failed, but I will always have a job because I've got an underlying skill set to either fall back on or, you know, I'm sure some would hire me going forward. You've got to be quite self-aware of what you are, because if you're self-aware enough to understand that that is you as a person, you are resilient, you can do that, you'll be fine. But if you're not self-aware enough to recognise that you're not, you know, it's a harder place.
I'd like to finish. Well, usually, Lexi, I'll ask a question, which is not the qualification or the title or job role. If you could look back and say, what characteristic has served you best, what would it be? But I imagine that your answer would therefore be self-awareness.
Intuitiveness is probably one of my strongest characteristics. Self-aware for sure is probably number two, but there's an instinctive, intuitive nature that I listen to quite often. And if it doesn't feel right, even if it's timing or something else, you know, not to be accused of procrastinating here and there, but if I'm dealing with a topic and I don't finish it off, it's because it's not the right time to finish it off. It's definitely this kind of intuitive, reactive, internal compass type quality that's literally made me who I am, I suppose.
To finish, Lexi, I'd like to talk about women in tech. There's an article written on you in The Guardian. Only 40% of women's wear designers are women. There's another stat. I think this is a quote from you, actually. When I see stats that female developers make up 11% of the workforce, it's clear that there is disparity. What would you say to a girl listening at the school who would like to go into fash tech?
There are different roles within a fash tech environment. So, you know, we are a fash tech business. We are primarily female consumer tech. That is our product category. But within our environment, you know, within our business, there are a number of roles. So of course we have this kind of pure technology roles, which are front end, back end, full stack, you know, developers. Our team who build this are mostly male, but our smartest, most intuitive and excited person is our front end developer, Vlada, who gets the product completely, loves it. So, you know, she completely embraces the use cases over and over again. And she helps me to think through product design on that. But that is one of anything up to seven people that we've had on the technology side that is a female, which is pretty poor. Now, that's not, you know, that's nothing to do with our recruitment policy. That's just, you know, the numbers game of who managed, you know, who's come into the project. And now if women want to work within pure tech roles, there's a pathway to get there, which is, you know, you're training in computer science at university, or you're taking courses to code, you're more maths biased. So you've kind of got, if you want to work within tech, it's not just pure technology roles that are open to you. But if you do want those, you've got to set yourself up educationally to get there. You know, now Marina and I come from, you know, an operations, a legal background. Marina comes from a marketing background. And then, you know, because we're in a digital product environment, the ability to market digitally becomes very important too. So it's content, content, content. And I think, again, that's probably where we attract most women. So there are many different types of roles open to individuals, including women, within our business. It's just what suits you in terms of personality, skill set, and your kind of core training to allow you to do that job.
You were running digital work experience, or a digital work experience program. Is that still going?
Yeah, we just opened it up to King Edwards as well. So we have one girl, I think, who's working with us at the moment. Yeah, we've had over 200 young women across. We started it last year, and I say we, it's all down to Marina, actually. So we were product testing last year, and Marina was quite involved with her old school. And, you know, it became clear, obviously, that all the work experience programs kind of fell by the wayside during COVID. So we started to set up digital ones. And, yeah, we've gone to, I think we're at about 7 or 8 schools now. And we've also started to work with Birmingham City University. And I've done a lecture series there, and we're just putting together what will be a joint department work experience program with up to 8 interns cross department to come and work with us over the next 4 months. And certainly, because obviously the nature of the product is female, our first outreach was to girls' schools to get their feedback and also their product ideas and content creating and playing with the app. So we've, you know, it's been very successful so far.
And this is open for 15 to 17 year olds, is that right?
Yeah, I mean, probably anyone from the age of 15 can get involved. The university program obviously extends to slightly older group, but we tend to bring them in for different thinkers. So we've also worked with Imperial College London. I've had 2 groups of master students come and work with me on projects. That's been great. We just opened it up to London Business School. We did a project with them. So, you know, I love working with young talent. You know, the ideas, the energy, it's awesome to wrap into a project. But, yeah, we've had some joyous successes with them.
And how can someone get involved if they're listening to this and they're already halfway through their email to you?
Well, open your browser, and if you just go onto the website, littleblackdoor.io, you'll find the help button, so you can press, or you can download the app and go through that and press help, and you come straight through to us.
Lexi, I'd like to say thank you ever so much for your time today. I feel like we've talked about a lot of subjects a little bit, whether it's what it's like to be an entrepreneur, to why fast fashion is evil, because it is.
It's not the best.
I could talk to you for so much longer, but thank you ever so much, and I hope that everything goes well with the launch.
Thank you very much, Ben. Appreciated.
Thank you for listening to Ed Talks. I hope that you've enjoyed today's conversation. If you have, it would be great if you could subscribe to this podcast on whatever app you're listening on, so you can keep up to date with future episodes. And if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, then we'd really appreciate it if you could leave your feedback in the review section. If you're listening on a platform where you can't leave your comments, then please do email me with your feedback. My email address is ben@soundrebel.co.uk. If you would like to feature on this podcast as a guest, then please email Adelaide Bailey at the Development Office. Her email address is aab@kes.beham.sch.uk. That's aab@kes.beham.sch.uk. She's also the person to email with any news that you think should be featuring in Old Ed's publications, either in print or online. Finally, if you think a podcast would enhance the communications of your business, organisation or charity, then I'd love to talk to you about producing it. My email address again is ben@soundrebel.co.uk. Thank you again for listening, and I hope you'll join me again.